Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Over the last 10 years, we've never seen such a high number of reported attacks on the health system as in 2022. The scale of it is just unimaginable.
Sudan's healthcare system's on the verge of collapse 2 months after fighting broke out between rival military factions. We'll look at the increasing targeting of hospitals from Sudan to Ukraine to Burma. Then, as Russia transfers tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus, we speak to Professor Jaber Ashkar, author of The New Cold War, The United States, Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. Then to South Africa to talk to Kumi Naidoo, the former head of Greenpeace and Amnesty. On Tuesday, he was forcibly removed from a shareholder meeting of a major bank financing, ECOP. That's the East African Crude Oil Pipeline.
What do we want? Justice. What do we want? What do we want? What do we want?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Sudan, a regional governor from Darfur was assassinated Wednesday after he publicly blamed the paramilitary rapid support forces and allied Arab militias for the genocide of civilians. West Darfur state governor Khamis Abakhar was abducted and killed hours after making the remarks in a TV interview. Reuters reports two government sources said the RSF was responsible for the killing. On Wednesday, the International Organization for Migration said fighting between rival military factions in Sudan has now displaced more than 2 million people from their homes, with more than 500,000 fleeing to neighboring countries. Nearly 1,000 civilians have been killed, according to a local monitoring group. In Ukraine, the mayor of Kryvyi Rih says Russian missiles struck two civilian industrial sites overnight, injuring at least one person. The attack came days after another attack on the central Ukrainian city killed 11 civilians. Elsewhere, Ukraine's military said it shot down 18 Russian drones over the Black City port, city of Odessa, overnight. And Russia's TASS news agency reports Ukrainian artillery fire killed a child in a Russian-occupied part of Kherson region. On Tuesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin met with pro-war bloggers at the Kremlin, where he said Russia's military operations in Ukraine have been plagued by shortages of precision-guided munitions, communications gear, aircraft and drones, as well as other equipment, in a rare admission. The leader of Belarus said Tuesday he's received nuclear weapons from Russia and won't hesitate to use them if his nation's security is at stake. President Alexander Lukashenko made the remarks in an interview with a Russian state TV channel Tuesday evening.
We have missiles and bombs that we have received from Russia, both that are three times more powerful than the ones used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There, more than 80,000 people died instantly, 250,000 overall. That's from one strike, and this one is three times more powerful. I don't know, up to 1 million people would die immediately if, God forbid, this weapon were used.
Exiled Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya called on the world leaders to respond to Russia's first deployment of tactical nuclear weapons outside its borders since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. She wrote on social media, quote, "It creates a serious threat to regional security and sets us on a dangerous path for nuclear escalation. The world must show Lukashenko and Putin that it won't give in to nuclear blackmail." Thousands of protesters took to the streets of cities across Poland Wednesday after a pregnant woman died when medical workers refused to provide her with a life-saving abortion. 33-year-old Dorota Lalik died of sepsis in May, 3 days after her water broke, and she was admitted to the John Paul II Hospital. The hospital has deep ties to the Catholic Church, and medical staff there opted out of providing abortion care, citing a so-called conscience clause allowed under Polish law. This is a protester at Wednesday's pro-choice march in Warsaw.
I came here because I do not agree with women dying, that they have no choice, that doctors have a so-called conscience clause. If they want conscience clauses, they would change their profession. Women are dying because of them and also because of the law that has been established in Poland.
Here in the United States, the Justice Department has charged an active-duty Marine and one other person for firebombing a Planned Parenthood clinic in Costa Mesa, California, with a Molotov cocktail in March of last year. The two arrested men, Chance Brannon and Tibet Urgul, could face up to 20 years in federal prison. In related news, a new report from the Center for Countering Digital Hate finds Google made over $10 million from ads by anti-abortion groups. The Google ads were for so-called crisis pregnancy centers, which aim to steer people away from having abortions while posing as reproductive health care clinics. The Southern Baptist Convention has voted to uphold the expulsion of two churches led by women pastors, tightening the church's restrictions on women, banning them not just from serving as pastors, but from having any kind of leadership position. The moves come after organizing by the Southern Baptist Church's ultra-conservative members. In climate news, officials in India and Pakistan have ordered the evacuation of more than 150,000 people as Cyclone Biparjoy makes landfall in India's Gujarat state. The storm crashed ashore earlier today near high tide with a storm surge that threatened to inundate low-lying coastal areas. It's just the third cyclone to hit India's west coast in nearly six decades. Here in the United States, thick smoke from dozens of wildfires burning in Canada settled over Wisconsin and Minnesota Wednesday, triggering air quality alerts for very unhealthy levels of fine particle and ozone pollution. The air quality index topped 240 in the Twin Cities, the region's worst levels on record. President Biden's vetoed legislation that would have rolled back a new rule limiting emissions from heavy-duty vehicles. The White House says the rule change will cut nitrogen oxide emissions in half by 2045, preventing thousands of childhood asthma cases and premature deaths every year. The bill to repeal the tougher emissions cleared the Senate in April with the support of Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and with ALN California Senator Dianne Feinstein absent. Meanwhile, the House of Representatives has failed in its effort to override President Biden's veto of legislation that would have blocked police accountability legislation passed by the Washington, D.C. City Council in the wake of George Floyd's murder. 13 Democrats joined with House Republicans in voting to overrule the D.C. law, which expands access to police disciplinary records and body camera footage, limits the use of tear gas and other chemical agents, and bans certain police tactics, including chokeholds. Washington, D.C. D.C.'s non-voting delegate to Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, said in a statement, quote, "The disapproval resolution is a profoundly undemocratic and paternalistic piece of legislation. Almost 700,000 people live in the nation's capital, and they're worthy and capable of governing their own local affairs," unquote. Here in New York, a grand jury's indicted former U.S. Marine Daniel Penny over the killing of Jordan Neely on a city subway on May 1st. Penny, who's white, held Jordan Neely in a chokehold until he died. Neely, a beloved street performer, was unhoused and hungry, crying out for help when the ex-Marine attacked him. The charges will be unsealed when Penny's arraigned. The date of his arraignment is expected to be announced today. The Federal Reserve has decided to hold interest rates steady after 10 consecutive increases since early 2022. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren welcomed Wednesday's announcement by Fed Chair Jerome Powell, writing, quote, "The Fed raised interest rates at the fastest pace in decades, and it needs to maintain this pause or risk throwing millions of Americans out of work," unquote. The European Union's advanced a major new law that would regulate artificial intelligence as governments around the world grapple with how to respond to the possible threats of the fast-moving technology. The EU draft law includes restrictions on the use of facial recognition and mandates disclosures of data by makers of chatbots and deepfake videos. This is European Parliament President Roberta Metsola.
Going forward, we are going to need constant, clear boundaries and limits to artificial intelligence. And here there is one thing that we will not compromise on. Anytime technology advances, it must go hand in hand with our fundamental rights and democratic values. And
finally, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres recently said he supports the idea of global watchdog for artificial intelligence that could play a role in similar to how the International Agency of Atomic Energy regulates nuclear technology.
The scientists and experts have called on the world to act, declaring AI an existential threat to humanity on a par with the risk of nuclear war.
Here in the United States, Jennifer DiStefano, an Arizona mother, testified at a Senate hearing this week about her harrowing experience with a deep fake scam that tricked her into thinking her daughter had been kidnapped. DiStefano says the fake kidnappers demanded a $50,000 ransom before she got in touch with her daughter, who was in fact safe and sound.
It was my daughter's voice. It was her cries. It was her sobs. It was the way she spoke. I will never be able to shake that voice and the desperate cries for help out of my mind. It's every parent's worst nightmare to hear your child pleading with fear and pain, knowing that they are being harmed and that you're helpless. The longer this form of terror remains unpunishable, the farther and more egregious it will become. There is no limit to the depth of evil AI can enable.
Meanwhile, election integrity groups have been sounding the alarm over the use of AI to misinform people ahead of the 2024 U.S. election. Florida's Republican governor, presidential hopeful Ron DeSantis, released an attack ad earlier this month showing AI-generated deepfake images of Donald Trump hugging and kissing Anthony Fauci. And a Guatemalan court Wednesday convicted prominent journalist Jose Ruben Zamora of money laundering and sentenced him to 6 years in prison, what rights groups have condemned as a trumped-up case and part of a crackdown on press freedom by the right-wing government of President Alejandro Giammattei. Zamora is the founder and president of the investigative newspaper El Periódico and has long reported on Guatemalan government corruption. The newspaper was forced to shut down in May after months of intensifying harassment and persecution. To see our interview with Jose Ruben Zamora's son, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with a humanitarian crisis unfolding in Sudan as the healthcare system there is collapsing after 2 months of fighting across Sudan between the army and the rapid support forces. Volunteers and aid workers are struggling to keep critical healthcare running. But the Sudan Doctors Trade Union says less than a third of hospitals in Sudan's conflict zones are still open. Many have been targeted by fighters. Those that continue to operate face cuts to power and water and a lack of staff, medicine, and dialysis supplies. Reports also show, since the outbreak of the conflict in April, rape survivors are struggling to access emergency contraception and abortion medication because a warehouse with nearly 50,000 post-rape medical kits has been cut off. This comes as a new report from the Safeguarding Health and Conflict Coalition concluded 2022 was the worst year for attacks against healthcare facilities and personnel worldwide in the last decade. The report found a 45% increase in reported incidents of violence against or obstruction of healthcare in conflict zones as compared to 2021, including in Sudan. Over half the documented attacks were in two countries, Ukraine and Burma. For more, we're joined in Geneva by Christina Villa, director of Insecurity Insight, which contributed to the new report, Ignoring Red Lines, Violence Against Healthcare and Conflict. And we begin in Houston with Dr. Kadir Dalouk, advocacy director of the Sudanese American Physicians Association, which is providing support to Sudan's healthcare facilities and services during the crisis. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!, but we begin with the Sudanese doctor. Dr. Dalouk, can you talk about the situation in Sudan today? Today marks the 2 months where these rival military forces have been attacking each other. Of course, the collateral damage, as they say, the horror, is the number of civilians who have died or are also at this point seeking health care in places where that many hospitals don't even exist anymore.
Good morning to you, to Christina, and to your audience and viewers. As you report and you correctly mentioned, what is happening in Sudan is a calamity. It's almost a nightmare that is getting worse every day. And our concern, if this continues and the conflict, you know, spreads to neighboring states, this might break into civil war pretty soon. What is happening in Darfur is a total disaster, especially in El Geneina, where hospitals are completely shut down and civilians are, you know, between death and, you know, caught into, you know, the armed conflict. They're not even able to flee to neighboring Chad. As you mentioned in Khartoum, two-thirds of the hospitals are out of service, evacuated or forced to, you know, to close. My colleagues who are working on the ground, they're working in very difficult situations. It's not even comprehensible. They're working with very little, if no supplies. The major concern we have is their safety. You know, healthcare professionals and providers are, you know, facing gunfire every day to reach to work and to their houses. They're completely burned out. They're not able to provide to their families because they have not had any salaries for months now. So it's not comprehensible the way they're working. And their safety is our biggest concern. They have been deliberately targeted since the conflict. Hospitals have been targeted. Almost 21 of our healthcare colleagues have lost their lives. A few days ago, one of our colleagues, he's a neurosurgeon. He lost his life while he was on duty serving in a hospital called Best Hospital in Khartoum. We as physicians have sworn an oath to treat and take care of civilians and military, whether it's in peace or it's in war. Me and my colleagues on the ground, they are doing their best to abide to this oath. Maybe the generals and those who are fighting have forgotten, you know, their oaths to defend the country and to defend civilians. And this is a reminder and a call to them that they should at least leave us do our duty.
And Dr. Dalouk, if you could speak specifically about what we mentioned in our introduction, namely the difficulties for women in accessing emergency abortion and reproductive rights medicine, because these rape kits, post-rape kits, tens of thousands of them are inaccessible. And this is in a moment in this conflict where there have been widespread reports of sexual violence and rape. And of course, in Sudan, abortion is illegal.
Well, it's very unfortunate that, you know, violence against women and rape is used as a weapon in this war. And this is not new. This has been, you know, the case in Darfur and the genocide that happened and the attacks back going back to 2003. So it's very unfortunate. You know, we are totally against, you know, rape and using, you know, women's body in this war. I think, you know, there are no supplies, period, to any civilians, including women, including children. For the last 2 months, there are, you know, infants who have been born, and there are totally no vaccinations. And we are going to see an emergence of infectious diseases that have almost, you know, have been eradicated, that they're going to emerge because there are no vaccinations that are happening to those children. And as you correctly said, there are no kits to provide to those rape victims. It's very unfortunate where, you know, the internally displaced is another group of people who are facing a lot of, you know, problems. You know, we are trying to support four different hospitals in Madani, which is a neighboring state. We are, as Sudanese American Physician Association, operating or funding the operation of the hospital of a hospital in Halfa, and as well in Niala, as well in Niala Hospital. But unfortunately, because of the, you know, blockage of, you know, the borders in Egypt, as well as in Ethiopia, as well as, you know, other countries are closing up their visa access to Sudanese. There is a lot of people who are in the borders. Halfa Hospital, for example, you know, is facing a huge number of patients that are people dying because, you know, we're not able to operate like a government. We are an organization. We are doing our best. But this is not enough. I think if we don't act...
Look, let me ask you something. Do you think the military forces are targeting hospitals and other healthcare facilities? You've stated that so far 11 ambulances have been attacked by strikes, that the rapid support sources have commandeered ambulances, cars from the Ministry of Health. The significance of this as we begin to wrap up?
Well, you know, as I said, hospitals and healthcare professionals have been deliberately targeted, and it's very unfortunate that, hospitals are used in this war, you know, as you know, areas where the conflict is going. These two generals are not abiding to any international law, not to any Geneva conventions, and I think what is important is safety of my colleagues on the ground. The impartiality of hospitals. Both parties are trying to force, you know, healthcare professionals to, you know, say that we are siding with this party or that party. This is not what we do. Our oath is to all civilians, and, you know, at times of war, this is not what we do. Our oath is towards those civilians and towards those who are injured, and, you know, this is what we do, and we want to abide to that. Me and my colleagues, you know, call for the international community to act now, not even tomorrow. You know, they have to do it now.
I'd like to bring in Christina Villa into the conversation. If you could talk about what's happening in Sudan in the context of the report that your organization has put out, ignoring red lines, violence against healthcare in conflict. Talk about what this report concludes.
Yeah, thanks so much. And most of all, thank you for putting this really important topic of violence against healthcare for discussion into your show, because it is always terrible when political conflict turns violent. And we've seen that in Sudan in past years during demonstrations and particularly now. But it is heartbreaking to see the personal consequences for people when they can't access healthcare in such situations. And I think you've already evoked several of these issues. You know, imagine a woman going into labor or needing emergency care after experiencing sexual violence, and then you have security forces using roadblocks to prevent access, and people seeking treatment when the hospitals are bombed or occupied and raided by security forces. And we've documented it numerous times for Sudan of military security forces going into hospitals, beating health workers there, arresting them in front of patients. And this increases the suffering for the civilians in conflict to incredible extent. And so much of these consequences could really be prevented if only healthcare would be properly protected in conflict. And that's such an important topic the international community needs to address more seriously.
And can you speak, Christina, about where these attacks are most prevalent, and also whether these attacks are mostly deliberate?
So our report for last year identified Ukraine and Myanmar as two countries where the whole health system is under an incredible attack. In Ukraine, some 11% of the health infrastructure has been damaged. And in Myanmar, the devastation is in so many areas through so many different ways, from arresting health workers, from the coup government bombing its own civilians. It is really, really close to unimaginable for people who live in more secure places, the extent of the violence that occurs. And these are the two countries where most events have been documented. But in total, we covered 42 countries, and it is so widespread and such a common problem in conflict.
Christina Villa, if you could talk about the best practices, though it's horrible to think in, you know, conflict regions, what are the best rules of war, but also the effect on healthcare workers specifically, and use specific examples.
I mean, there is a law of war, and that is very clear, that healthcare should be protected and healthcare needs to be provided to all sides in conflict. And this is really something that the humanitarian community tries to do, to not ask who the person who needs care is, but to offer it to everyone. But the real problem is that in conflicts like Sudan, but so many others, it is the conflict parties that do not respect these rules, and that they go on deliberate attacks on the health systems in many places, and also the health workers, because they're just so important in preventing further consequences to civilians. And it is so there are practical things that humanitarian agencies can and are doing, but one of the big concerns is that there's just no impunity for this. So we have these laws, but there's never any consequences. And there, unfortunately, we have very few examples of any attempts being made to actually address that these rules of law are just not respected.
Christina Villa, very quickly before we wrap up, you've said that Russia's attacks on Ukraine are not without precedent. They're just different in terms of scale and intensity. The World Health Organization also found earlier this year that the number of attacks on healthcare facilities and personnel in Ukraine was the highest ever recorded in any humanitarian crisis. So what do you mean when you say they're not without precedent?
We've seen it in Syria, hospitals being deliberately bombed. We've seen it as far back as in Chechnya in 1996, when Russian forces attacked an ICRC-run hospital. So it definitely is nothing, unfortunately, nothing new. But we're also seeing it in many other countries. And it may also be worth to note that the Wagner forces in Africa have also been attacking health systems in the Central African Republic, for example.
Christina Villa, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of Insecurity Insight. We'll link to your new report, Ignoring Red Lines, Violence Against Healthcare in Conflict. And Dr. Khidir Dalouk, Advocacy Director of the Sudanese American Physicians Association, speaking to us from Houston. Coming up, as Russia transfers tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus, we'll speak to Professor Gilbert Achkar, author of The New Cold War, The United States, Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. Stay with us.
And that's when he said, I don't want to be washed up without you, evolved to a lump in a shell, looking out at the world with no legs, no hands, no head, no glands, no plans, no throat, just sand. She said, well, don't go backwards, don't stay sat down too long, don't be background sound drowned out, don't get stuck, move on, don't get caught, found out. Don't get lost, don't get crossed out, don't get squashed, don't come back, don't leave, don't get drum tracks, don't get reverb, I get you, but you don't get me. He said, I never see more than I see right now, but we've never known less, we've never known trust, no wisdom. How can a million blips with their silicone chips and an Instagram twitch prepare the deep cracks to the kingdom? She said, we're defined by our ill-formed opinions, refreshed by the shock of it all. How novel.
Geronimo Blues by Speaker's Corner Quartet. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We turn now to Ukraine and what our next guest calls the new Cold War. The president of Belarus has announced Russia's begun transferring tactical nuclear weapons to the former Soviet state, which shares a nearly 700-mile border with Ukraine. In an interview, Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko warned he's ready to use the nuclear weapons if Belarus faces aggression. Meanwhile, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has urged allies to dig deep to provide more arms and ammunition to help Ukraine as it launches its counteroffensive against Russia. Austin's comment comes 2 days after Russian President Vladimir Putin admitted Russia's facing a shortage of ammunition, drones, and warplanes, despite a sharp increase in military production. In other news from Ukraine, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, is back in Ukraine to visit the Russia-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest nuclear plant in Europe. The IAEA has expressed concern the recent destruction of the Kakhovka Dam could impact the plant's supply of water needed for cooling. This all comes as the U.S. State Department has announced Tony Blinken's plan to leave Friday for a trip to China this weekend, the first by U.S. Secretary of State since 2018. In February, China put forward a 12-point peace plan to end the war in Ukraine. We're joined now by Joubert Ashkar,